Blog Talk Radio.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and they're carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Time for a Plan. Today is Tuesday, October the 12th, 2010, and today we'll be delving into the eighth segment of the show, Time for a Plan, with Gary Hunt. And welcome to the show, Gary. How are you doing?
Just fine. How are you doing, Randy? Getting plenty of sleep, I understand?
I'm getting tons of it, tons and tons of sleep. Gotta love it.
Trouble is, it's spread out through the whole week, huh?
Yeah, that's the only problem, man. I get about, you know, I get 8 hours of sleep every 2 days. So how are you doing? So how are you doing today, and how's life treating you?
Well, pretty good. We just had a quick overview of the plan on another radio program. I sent announcements out to the people on the committee mailing list and my mailing list and others, and it was pretty interesting, but it wasn't quite what I expected. I ended up being on the hot spot, and it seems that the plan does address all the concerns that were raised in it. So it was rather interesting. I'm kind of pleased after that the plan is viable as we thought it was. And let's see, I guess first we've got to go with the disclaimer. The question arose a while back that could a revolution be conducted in the modern world considering modern technology, extensive government troops, and battlefield weapons? Well, at first I thought it was an ominous and daunting task, but after thinking about it and thinking back to the founding fathers, I realized that we probably could construct a plan and that would emulate what the founding fathers did in the modern playing field, of course. And so I've developed this theoretical plan that could be used to restore the Constitution should people decide to. Now, last week when we were talking about it on the chat, it seemed there was a lot of confusion over the idea of cells or security teams. And So I think we want to kind of revisit that very briefly. It would take maybe 10 or 15 minutes to discuss that so that the thought's not lost. Perhaps I wasn't very complete in expressing it, but I did give two links. Randy, did you get the links up somewhere for the...
For the...
The various links that go with the plan?
Oh, no, I haven't gotten those up yet. I'm going to put those in the committee for our... I'm going to make a new forum for that in the forum post, but no, I haven't gotten those up yet.
Okay, well, there's two plans, or two articles. One is called Our Security Team, and the other one is Leaderless Resistance, or I think I called it something else where I linked it. But the idea in both of these, the security team was one that we put together in 1992, myself and some friends of ours, and there were seven of us in it, and we had known each other. I didn't know some of the people that came into the team, but other people that I knew had known for a long period of time had known them. We just never met, but we found we had something in common, and we came together as a security team to look out and protect us should anything ever happen. This is back in 92, 18 years ago. We still back then we anticipated problems from the government because three of us in particular were very outspoken about the government. Of those three, two have been executed by the state of Alabama, and I'm the remaining one, so that gives you an idea of how this thing plays out. But the security team was to protect ourselves, and it came in very handy a number of times. We were able to hide somebody that the FBI was looking for until he decided to give himself up. It was about 3 months. We knew that our backs were covered. We even set up a dead man switch type scenario when I got back from Waco, where I had to call every 2 hours a phone number and let them know that I'm still okay. If not, then everybody was going to scramble and try and figure out what happened to me. And we kept that going for about 4 or 5 days until we realized there was probably no problem. The night I first got back, I stayed in a motel room rather than at my house, and I had two people with me armed, ready to defend me if anything happened. That was a security team. Now, its purpose at that time was kind of like the militia, the inherent right we have. It's the right to protect ourselves and our property individually or collectively, and so our security team was a collective. We also talked about doing things should the need arise, and so I'm going to give you a little idea how we had structured it so that you might get the idea. Any one of the seven could develop another team subordinate to them, under them. That team would never know who the other six players were. There would be one person on that lower team that would have access with an envelope that would be sealed, and if it was ever found out that envelope was open, the person on that team, every time they met, would say, I want to see the envelope, to make sure that it hadn't been opened. We were very cautious about security. But that was a way for that team to get in touch should something happen to their, let's say, sponsor. We also had a plan. We had three or four areas picked out on a quad sheet that were out in the jungle in Central Florida where we could meet, and the instructions were very simple. If we ever have to go there, when you tell your team and start going there, if anybody hesitates, oh, I got to call my wife or any reason, to once they're brought together and you start heading towards the location, any reason that seemed reluctant or would give them an opportunity if they drop a piece of paper or anything, that court, jury, and executioner right there because of the risk inherent to the rest of us should they find out where the operation was. We'd also talked about some things that I won't talk about now, but as we talk about the cells and the groups, I think what we might have talked about might become apparent. Now, Lewis Beam wrote an article called Leaderless Resistance. It was based on the same concept, is where you have a team that has no leader. You have no allegiance. You have no ties to anybody. The difference between, and basically otherwise it was the same thing. They were to protect themselves. They could conduct covert activities or anything. The difference between his and ours is we had a means to communicate at a higher level, so we had a structure. And we could, if we found another team somewhere, send one of our people to communicate with them. In fact, we even had a backup system. When they communicated, $2 bills would be torn in half, and each side would get half of each dollar bill. That way, if either one of these two contact people were taken out, one other person could go out with that dollar bill and identify himself. And we had said, you know, talked about what various methods we could use to make sure that the other party knew about, which would probably be an ad in a newspaper, and where to meet, so that that continuity could be maintained should one or the other be taken out. And actually, two people on our side would have a dollar bill, and two people on the other side, and the bills were A and B. So if we put an ad in the paper, want to meet here or there at a certain time, A, then they would bring the A dollar, whoever had the A dollar. So we had thought of all these things. We never implemented that part of it. We never fully developed it because we never set up another team. But leaderless resistance is absent that structure. Now, the security team, though, could get in touch with the local committee of safety and communicate with them, not divulging anything, but saying, hey, I understand so-and-so who was died of lead poisoning the other night. Here's what we knew about that person, and all the dirt on them goes out. But what it takes is just like 230 years ago, people need to be willing to go out and break the law and risk the consequences. Now, there's two aspects to that. One is breaking the law. Now, as far as breaking the law, destroying property, kidnapping somebody, or executing somebody. Now, the government said we can execute because if you read, let's talk about the Constitution, it explains. And as I explained that on the other program tonight, it woke up in people's mind. If the government has the authority to kidnap, torture, or assassinate, all of their authority came from us. So that means the government assumed that we had the authority to kidnap, torture, or assassinate, and we gave it to them. Then I looked through the Constitution, and I didn't see anything that prohibited us from those rights, that denied us because we gave them to government. It wasn't in the Constitution. So if I take the government's interpretation of the Constitution, I can assume that I have the right to kidnap, assassinate, or torture somebody. So well, if NP, for example, if you don't know who NP is, she's the Speaker of the House. If NPs, for example, were kidnapped or died of a sudden case of lead poisoning, then the dirt on her be made public, and some degree of mitigation over the fact that NP died last night in the middle of the night, sudden case of lead poisoning or a heart attack, whatever the press says, that the Patriot press comes out and say, well, good riddance to bad rubbish. Glad it happened to her. It couldn't happen to a nicer person. Trying to get people to think that there is something about this person that might have justified this action, whether they call it a heart attack or an assassination. It doesn't matter what the government calls it. The fact is, we go out with the positive press saying good riddance to bad rubbish. Whatever happens, that the Patriot press has to take another side on the story. Whether you're directly or indirectly in contact with the Committee of Safety, whether you're part-time committee of safety, and then outside of that official capacity, you're on a security team. The security team can also have a structure similar to the militia and the committee of safety, which is that the older people like me that can't get around so well, we're more of the advisory or the executive or the civil part of that security team, and the younger people are the militia part of the team, and they do the covert operations, and we do the rationalization, the PR, and help them pick targets. Now, picking targets is something that needs to be considered very carefully. If you kill somebody that's popular and doesn't have any dirt on them, you get bad reputation for us, and the entire plan is based on us doing the right thing. Now, you're working outside the law, but let's go back to the colonial times. A bunch of Indians went down to Boston, dumped a few hundred thousand dollars worth of tea in the harbor, destroyed private property. And with all the people in Boston, there was not one witness. There was not one person willing to sit on a jury to convict those people if they found them. And more importantly, and according to our Constitution, anybody charged with an infamous crime, Fifth Amendment, infamous crime, can only be held to answer under indictment by a grand jury. Now, grand juries are not the ones we see operating today. Constitutionally, they are not subject to U.S. attorney or the state attorney or the county attorney's authority. They are independent. The foreman is the executive, whoever selected foreman is the executive of the grand jury. So unless the grand jury, under that original concept of grand jury, which there's a link to in the, when we get the links up, unless the grand jury presents an indictment, there's no authority to arrest this person. And we can look at a Supreme Court decision from 1890, John Bad Elk, where John Bad Elk shot a law enforcement officer who had come to arrest him without authority. He killed the guy. He was found guilty of murder. Went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had said it's a misdemeanor or no crime at all because it was an unlawful warrant. So whoever these guys are on the security team, if people come into your community, Militia and Committee of Safety's community, and say, we're looking for John Doe, we understand that he committed a crime and we've got a warrant for his arrest, we'll see that warrant. Well, where's the grand jury indictment? We don't have one. This is good enough. No, it's not. We abide by the Constitution. We can't help you at all. Goodbye. And you protect those people because they have not been brought under charges in accordance with the Constitution. So your obligation is to protect people that have not been, have been denied due process according to the Constitution, not due process the way the lawyers tell you it is, but what was intended by the founders, and that information is abundantly clear in the things that that I've posted on the webpage, the Supreme Court decision on John Bad Elk, the truth about the treatise on grand juries and petite juries, and how they're not subject. The petite jury judges both the fact and the law. The grand jury is not under the control of the government. In fact, it can indict people in the government, as happened after Ruby Ridge with Lon Hiroshi. But then the federal government took it over and said, there's no crime here and let them go. So we're denied justice in this country. So the militia and the Committee of Safety have a responsibility to protect their community. And so their position in the first two steps there of the plan would be strictly to make sure that if anything happened within their community, it was in accordance with the Constitution and the laws consistent with the Constitution. But it just takes a brave soul to go out and kidnap somebody, tar and feather them, and drag them through the streets. Now, the difference is you would be charged with a crime here, but back then they seemed to get away with it. Why? Because the law required the grand jury indictment, and it required witnesses, and it would require jurors. And there wasn't a sheet that if you think this guy did this, you've got to find him guilty and sentence him to death. No, it was up to the jury. So until we get that back, you're dealing in a very gray area. But if you have people you know and trust, now who do you know and trust? If you've known them for 5 years and they've not been charged with a crime to your knowledge, they might be trustworthy. If you think that they will cover your back if the shooting starts, more than likely they are trustworthy. But you got to feel them out. You got to go carefully because if you decide to step into this venue, you're going to be walking on spearhead turf. You're going to be doing like those few back then were willing to do, to risk themselves to let the government know that you better fear God and the people.
Now, real quick, before we move on to there, I wanted to make a point. I was watching TV years and years ago. New York was having a crime spree. The mayor of New York City got up on TV because everybody in the city was screaming. And he said, if you want something done about it, why don't you get out there and start arresting some of these criminals? You have all the power of the police yourself.
That was some time ago.
And, I think that just lays to point what you were saying. Government, all power that the government has derives from we the people. We give them that power. If we don't have that power ourselves, how do we give it to them?
Well, our COPS Constitutional is a PDF on the library page that interestingly goes back and filled in a lot of gaps to me on how things worked back then. The citizen's arrests were about the only ones made. Occasionally, a constable or a justice of the peace would be involved in arrest. More often, they just issued the warrant, and then whoever wanted the person arrested would go out and gather some other people's posse and make the arrest, and then turn him over to be put in jail and held trial. Now, if it was a false arrest, the repercussions could come back to whoever had the warrants sworn out. So it was kind of an interesting system then, and it's kind of hard to conceive how it would work today. But the balance, if we have a police force, has to be a lot more moderated than it is now. They have become the standing army because the standing army was the British soldiers in Boston who, without permission, fired on civilians and killed five of them. They stood trial for that crime because they didn't have permission from the governor to fire. And even the redeeming factor for them was it was determined by the jury that they acted in self-defense. So the only time you can shoot somebody is in self-defense if you're a cop, law enforcement. But when you give the civil authority and the military authority to one man, a police officer, he is a direct violation of the provision prohibiting standing armies. That is what they feared, was somebody with an arbitrary power, a power to take away your liberty, even if he was just pissed off at you, which, believe me, happens a lot. So, yeah, things have changed a lot, and it's really hard to get back to the way things that were. A lot of reading, and every once in a while I run across something like our COPS Constitutional, which was fascinating, and I just found it 2 or 3 weeks ago. And was completely surprised because here gives me a picture of what the world was like then. And I've been talking about like now, and I knew this isn't what the founders intended, but I didn't have a picture of what it was like then. And now we have a picture of what it's like then. It just takes constantly searching to come up with what you need to do what you got to do. So anyway, any more questions on that? If not, we'll go on to where are we at? We're at, step six. This is an important one because, and this was a primary point of discussion tonight on the other program. It's continuation of flow of goods, utilities, and communications. Now, what the other person mentioned then that I thought was rather interesting is he knows some people that are predicting an economic collapse. And if that economic collapse comes, we're going to not be able to get food or anything else. We're basically, he's talking about up to 80% of the people in this country starving to death or being taken out by one means or another, and only 20% remaining, and the lack of food and medical supplies being a primary one. Well, this addresses that, and maybe it's not comprehensive enough after that discussion. I've got to go back and add some to this, but the overview is we have a very important responsibility that must be accepted by the committees, the militia, and the correspondents. Now, the correspondents are the communication with the other committees. It is vital to the interest of the community to do all that is possible to maintain a flow of food and utilities and to maintain communications, transportation for the general population. I should have energy in here as well. It can be anticipated that the rebels will attempt to lay blame on the citizens that are seeking to return to constitutional government as the cause of any disruption of services. On the other hand, if those who are seeking return to proper government can maintain those facilities or services available as best they can, it will be reflected in the assurance to the people that they are doing all they can to maintain and assure that those services remain available. So where does this come into play? Let's say you're in the Midwest and there's a big slaughter and packaging facility near you. It probably belongs to one of two or three big corporations right now, but see, your plan now has to incorporate getting involved with that facility, getting those people in there to continue producing and transporting food as expeditiously as possible to keep that flow going. Now, if they're making exorbitant profits, you might tell them, you know, screw your stockholders, you're only allowed 10% over cost to produce this, but we're in an emergency situation. We've got to keep the food flowing. Are you with us or against us? And anybody with any reluctance, hey, fire them. Find some people in the facility that can handle that position that will take the oil CO. Do as much as possible to keep the people there employed and productive and on our side and encouraged to become more productive than the union allowed them to in the past. If they could only butcher a side a day, then you want them to butcher a whole cow a day, whatever it takes to encourage them to keep the flow of food. This is true on food, communications, public services, water, sewer, natural gas. If there's facilities in your area, the militia, as soon as they're able to, has to go into those facilities. The liaison committee hopefully will have already contacted the people and made it a smooth transition from functioning under federal agencies to functioning under the people themselves and basically a free market economy, however, limiting profit. Somebody on the other program brought up Monsanto. That's fine. Find the Monsanto plant. One, you will stop production of GMO seed. Number two, you will increase production of heirloom seeds, so seeds we will regenerate, that you can grow seeds out of. Three, you will drop all licenses. Four, you will put a 10% over cost on seeds and 10% over cost on Roundup or any other chemicals that are being used. You will continue to work towards returning to traditional farming as much as possible, not controlled farming by virtue of your license. Are you with us or against us? Now, everybody that works there should sign an loyalty oath. And remember the loyalty oath, I mentioned a phrase out of an old one from colonial times, which was, I realize that if I violate this oath, that I am guilty of being a traitor. Well, what's the punishment for a traitor? Well, in time of war, it's death. So that loyalty oath becomes pretty important because they've agreed to help you or that they're a traitor. Now, you don't have to kill them necessarily. You could fire them or you could put them in prison, whatever you deem appropriate. If they did sabotage, I'd say that as an example, they'd probably be executed. But if they just refuse to work or they just slow things down or for some reason they're not cooperating and going back towards the free market economy and making sure that the seed is provided to the agricultural industry so they can grow their annual crops, that they have violated that oath and should be dealt with. Same thing with petroleum. We have the ability in this country to supply our current needs. Now, the needs now are excessive. You got kids cruising the boulevard and things like that, so somehow there has to be a reduction of frivolous travel and an increase in the importance of necessary travel until everything's worked out. But going to Houston and telling them to open the valves and going to the refineries and telling them that you want rapid flow, which they don't do now because they want to control the prices, because chances are, except for what might be in transit already, we can't expect oil to come from the Middle East or anywhere else. We're going to have to provide our own, and we're going to have to look at a degree of rationing, only as necessary, parking a lot of cars, but we want to keep the oil flowing so that emergency services, fire, hospital, and everything, transportation of goods and products, can continue. There might be some hardships. For example, if China decides not to send any more televisions over here, the only televisions over here not owned already are in warehouses, and when they're gone, they're gone, which creates an opportunity for black market and everything else, but there's not much we can do about that. But later on, we'll get into the economy and how, I think it's step nine, we can actually deal with continuing trade with China or other countries. But at this point, it's very important that all the facilities be maintained open, that hospitals be maintained open, treated the same way. Everybody signs a loyalty oath. If they refuse to, they're fired. Find somebody that works there that's willing to step up into their position as you need to supplement it with other people. There are a lot of nurses that got tired of the politics of hospitals that might be willing to come back to work as nurses in assistant hospitals. But it'll be up to the committee then to maybe establish a committee for medicine and make sure all the doctors are advised that their charges will not be based on Medicare anymore. They will be based upon reasonable, and reasonable is probably somewhere around $50 an hour or something, you know, getting away from the rate that has liability, and then explain that there will be no liability for malpractice. People are human. People err. And this liability thing is just food for the attorneys. They get 40% on contingency or 30%. They're getting filthy rich, so they want the awards to be up. If your son dies because the doctor fucked up, it's a shame. But your son's dead, and money will not bring him back. There should be some restitution, but it shouldn't be $20 million more than he'd ever make in his lifetime. There's an absurdity to that. And so the doctors have to pay those premiums, so the prices are ridiculous. Now, if there's no insurance, then it has to be something that could be bartered. You know, a check on the doctor, I need a checkup like they used to do, or whatever is necessary. But the committee has to determine how they're going to deal with making sure that medicine is readily available to everybody. Now, we'll get to the some of the everybody's eventually, but not at this point. Like illegal everybody's.
You know, we had talked about command and control last night, and the things you were talking about, keeping vital infrastructure, trade, supplies, things like that working and flowing, is vital, and that's all a part of, and what you're talking about here is just another, is one of those aspects of command and control.
No, it's civil government. There's a difference between the two.
Well, yeah.
Martial law would be command and control. Civil government is the people acting on their own behalf. So, yes, they're similar, quite similar, but one has a rigid format.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Command,
one has, yeah.
The other one, the people are the power.
Right, okay.
But, yes, when I listened to the program last night, it is very much the same. But, you know, the military, I was told this when I was in the Army, the Army is the epitome of communism. It's the epitome of communism. So it works there. You have to have that rigid structure. You have to have obedience. You know, the training I went through, everything. For years, I didn't realize why everything was the way it was. And then finally it dawned on me why it was. Because there has to be absolute obedience. There has to be a response. Because when you're in a combat situation, you have to deal with it. And you can't sit around and say, well, should we defend this side of the post or that side? Somebody's got to take charge. You might make the wrong decisions. It might cost you all your lives. But you've got a better chance trying with a concerted effort than you do with a bunch of individual efforts. And so that structure becomes absolutely necessary and requires suicidal sacrifice on occasion. Now, in civilian life, suicidal sacrifice is totally voluntary. In the military, it's an order. And it can be a lawful order. So there are differences between the two. Historical perspective on what we're talking about. During the course of the Revolutionary War, postal services, currency, maintenance of roads and bridges, ports and harbors, to the extent as possible, were maintained by the colonial forces. A number of new roads were built, and in many instances, old trails were converted into new roads. So they did back then keep those things going. Franklin worked out a postal system during the Revolution so that the message would go out. You know, the British system was abandoned, and it was pretty much private, and so it gave Franklin the opening to develop what eventually became the United States Post Office. Every effort was made to continue the importation of goods, both military and otherwise. Trade relations were established, and the first salute cannon fired, which was a cannon fired in salute to an American vessel, was made in the Dutch West Indies. So right away they established relationship with France, Holland, to some degree Spain, and many other countries for trade purposes. Now, the British fleet controlling the seas sank or captured a lot of the goods that were being shipped here, but there was a flow of goods. And if possible, we want to try and maintain that flow, but it depends on the cooperation of other nations. And the unfortunate situation we find ourselves in now is the Federal Reserve. Now, right now, the dollar is on the decline. And is very possibly on the point of total collapse. Well, any fiat system collapses eventually, and That's a whole other story. But if we can get other countries to recognize future obligations on our part to continue trade, and that shouldn't be that hard. For example, Australia exports a lot of beef. You'd be surprised how much of the beef you eat didn't come from this country. It came from Australia. So the committees communicate with Australia and say, look, we promise to pay. Now, if you don't send that here, you can let it rot down there in Australia. I'm sure the flies would love it. But it's in your best interest to keep our good favor by shipping beef up here because we need it desperately. We've got a lot of problems to deal with, and so we'd like to write IOUs, just like California does, for the beef. So it comes into the system, we have beef. If we can be maintained open, it reduces the burden. But it is possible that we can sustain the legal people in this country with the ability that we have to produce food now. Likewise, with controlled transportation, we should be able to keep both power and transportation available on an as-necessary basis rather than a frivolous basis. So the means are still in this country. Now, we can't make color televisions. Motorola gave that up about 20 years ago. But, hey, somebody from old Motorola might start thinking, once this starts happening, that, hey, maybe we can have American-made televisions again, because eventually we're going to have to get into tariffs and things that allow the American economy to come back up. And when I get to the economic plan, you'll understand the necessity of a balance of trade. But that's down the road still. Through local supply, especially food and forage, we're deficient in quantity. Many other products continue to be available throughout the Revolutionary War. So the role of the committee. Committees need to be ever vigilant within their areas, the needs, and especially the absence of services. If disruption occurs, they need to respond quickly and effectively to assure restoration as soon as possible. They also need to assure that all personnel within their authority extend the greatest consideration possible to the general public, and when abuses occur, to discipline as necessary those who would undermine the sacred responsibility of honest consideration to the public. They also need to, within their area, secure transportation, communication, public utilities, food production, facilities, agricultural facilities to the extent, as I discussed, that they encourage the continued production of those products and that they go into the supply system throughout the country. You can't hoard everything where you are. We've got to maintain the continuity of the entire system that currently is controlled rigidly by the administrative agencies of government to the benefit of some and to the detriment of others. Back to a free market economy means the production of food and other supplies. The Correspondence Committee needs to make sure that they effectively disseminate information showing the rebel side is responsible for outages and the constitutional forces are vigilant in addressing maintenance of services if at all possible. The single area of concern may quite easily be identified as the most important element of their activities. Government, after all, is there to ensure that general welfare is maintained. And if we assume the role of the government, we have to maintain ensure that the general welfare is maintained. That's not welfare. That's general welfare. Militia duties unless life is at stake, maintain a very high regard for all orders and policies directed at maintaining services to the general population. So they might be, you might have two or three guys 24 hours a day at a production facility to make sure everything goes smoothly, to report if they've got people that seem to be obstructing the flow of things. But at this point, we're beginning to transition into the provider of goods and services, and especially food, to the people. Now, just think of that. Now, I've been trying to think of names, and I've been calling the other side the rebels. They could be the usurpers. We could be the restorers. It doesn't matter. I'm not sure which is best yet. If you all want to vote on it, give me some ideas. I'd appreciate it. But if the restorers are making it known that we are making sure that you got a hamburger in the local grocery store and that the local grocery store stays open, then people are going to tend towards our side and maybe even join us. And that's the idea. The whole concept that they talked about in Vietnam, the hearts and minds of the people, didn't start with Vietnam. It was first formalized in Vietnam. It existed in the during the Revolution when Washington had very specific instructions at Valley Forge not to steal anything from anybody, not to take away enough that they could not survive the winter themselves, and to offer a receipt for everything taken. That was hearts and minds. Still pissed some people off because they couldn't make their profit on it, but for the most part, the outrage over having our substance taken away and we starving to death did not occur because Washington laid out very strict rules for forage. So from there we go from to step seven, extension of influence into the state government. As we discussed before, as it occurred at the county level, when sufficient progress has been made in securing substantial areas within the state, even if the capital of the state remains in rebel hands, an interim government can be established to enhance the efforts of the committees, militia, and the network of correspondents. Many state agencies have operation centers throughout the state. These facilities can be secured, personnel evaluated, loyalty oaths administered, and continuance of services provided if within constitutional authority. That means shut down the welfare office, but you do have to make provision for people to eat. They can't buy an iPod with their credit card they got from welfare, but you do have to make sure that food's available and medical. Roads and bridges need to be maintained open. Those facilities exist and can be supervised by militia, committee members, or existing personnel who have taken loyalty oath. This will be true of other state facilities as well. Those facilities which operate outside of the constitutional authority should remain closed or rented out, sold, or otherwise utilized to provide financial assistance to the efforts to restore the constitutional government. So the welfare office, you know, you might use it as a soup kitchen, but you might just put a sign up there saying, if you need food, come down here. We'll provide food. Since all the states have adopted constitutions, those existing constitutions should, in most cases, provide sufficient security for the people and their rights. It should be understood that at the end of the Civil War, many states were required to submit new constitutions to the federal government for approval prior to ratification. During that same period, many states amended their constitutions to come in line with the federal government. Now, this is where it gets rather interesting. All the states that came in afterwards seem to have a bunch of set conditions in their Arizona, New Mexico, set conditions that were probably required by the federal government. I don't know historically whether they were or not, but all of a sudden certain elements in the Constitution began occurring that never occurred before after the Civil War. So it is recommended that all states revert to their respective constitution and laws as they existed on July 4th, 1860. Why July 4th? Well, we're talking about our independence. That's what we're building everything upon. And 1860 was before the Civil War, before the federal government started a lot of things, martial law, invasion of sovereign nations, the other states, and all the other things that they did, the denial of states' rights. So the point, if we want to work forward in line with the Constitution, we can either go to today and try and undo tens, hundreds of thousands of laws and weigh their constitutionality and say yes or no, or we go back to 1860 and then look for the laws that might be good and reenact those, any constitutional amendments that might be good and re-ratify those. So the laws in the Constitution would go back to July 4th, 1860, or the nearest to them for states that came in after States admitted to the Union after that day should review their respective constitution with regard to what is inconsistent with the purpose of the Constitution or appears to be a federal requirement for admission to the Union. This course precludes the necessity of reviewing thousands of laws to determine if they are constitutional and in the best interest of the people. constitutional amendments can be ratified if they are in the best interest of the people, and laws that serve that purpose can be reenacted. It would appear to be far less difficult to begin from then and work forward than to piecemeal undo the plethora of legislation that has been enacted with has not been enacted with the best interest of the people in mind. So once we take a state one at a time, they start following these guidelines, and it'll go even further about the legislature. So it is also time in each, as each state reenters the constitutional union, to declare their purpose, a declaration of dissolution of government, which purpose is to present to the world the cause for which the constitutional return is sought, should be declared and made public. Now, let me explain what that is. I've heard for years people want to rewrite the Declaration of Independence. And the question I have for them is, who are you declaring independence from? Well, nobody could really answer me who we were declaring independence from. They want the restitution, restoration of the Constitution. So what this says is declaration of the dissolution of government. The dissolved government is that that resides acting under the authority of the Constitution, but outside of that authority, which is a de facto government rather than a government by right. The following is a proposed document to that end. It should be considered only to be a model during the course of conflict as things occurred during the Revolutionary War. More elements of tyrannical or unconstitutional events occurred. Some of these elements that had been suggested earlier by the colonists were abandoned as insufficient in the overall. At the time that the participating states submitted the declaration, it should be brought up to the needs and exigencies of the time. Let me explain, too. The Declaration of Independence, five of the items under the Declaration of Independence, all came as a result of the conflict that had occurred a little over a year before then. There were no foreign troops in this country, for example, prior to the beginning of the Revolution, April 1917-75. And there, I don't recall right now what the others are, but five of those were based on acts that occurred after the fact. So that might be one that was added. Now, this is something that I drew up. Its language will tend to emulate the Declaration of Independence, and you'll see that, and I think it's appropriate, though we're not seeking independence. When a government properly instituted under the authority of the people by virtue of the Constitution of the United States of America has abrogated its responsibility under said Constitution and has removed itself from responsibilities imposed upon it by said Constitution, and when those people choose to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to recognize such dissolution of government. Now, this is an explanation of the rest of the world why we're doing what we're doing. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and property. That to secure these rights within a society, governments are instituted among men of that society, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. When that government becomes destructive of those ends by usurpation of granted authority, not granted by the people, or by abrogation of the responsibility under the Constitution, it is the right of the people to reinstitute that government on its original foundation and to amend that foundation to assure that usurpations and abrogations do not recur. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they have become accustomed. there went a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object. The events are designed to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide for new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these states united under and by said constitution, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to amend their former system of government. The history of all three branches of the present government is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To provide these facts, let these facts be submitted to a candid world. So you can see that pretty much emulates it. Now, I've listed about 30-some things, and I don't know if you want me to go through them or not.
Your show. You flow with what you want to. I'll just toss in some questions here and there.
Well, why don't you pop in with some questions now? Let me drink a water and rest my tongue.
Okay. Well, I got a few questions for you. So far, we've talked about many different things: the committees of safety, the militia, and security teams. Now, the security teams that you brought about, their actions kind of, you know, these actions kind of reflect the actions of, like you had mentioned, the dumping of the tea in Boston Harbor, things like that. Now, the question I ask is, if a country, you know, any country, you know, this is, like you had mentioned, this is a hypothetical academic foray into a hypothetical situation. So any country, Laos, Cambodia, you pick the country, you name it, where tyranny is rising or has risen up or is already in force. More specifically, I guess, when tyranny is first rising, you know, when should – I pose this question to Joe Martino as well. You know, when should people really start formulating plans and taking action to combat tyranny?
Well, let's go back to what I talked about at the beginning, the security teams and that. Now, we had a problem back about 15 years ago when an overzealous patriot attacked a building in Oklahoma City and blew it up and killed a bunch of people with it. It was easy then for, and the people that did it, Linda Thompson, Mark Kornke, and Bo Grice were the prime movers in getting people to say, oh, he must be a government agent, he couldn't have done that, he's not an expert in demolition or anything. Now, I can dispute all those, and I can probably prove that they're wrong. But what happened is we turned against a guy that thought he could get the ball rolling. And, I've not talked with McVeigh, but I've corresponded with him, and I've read the account that he dictated to the two attorneys or two writers. And I have no doubt that his reason was the same as mine, except I would have done it at night and blown up the building. But we can't fault him because he did something. The rest of us have done nothing. So if we have security teams go cause NP to have a sudden case of, or to disappear or have a sudden case of lead poisoning in the middle of the night, we can't condemn that act. We can either encourage it, support it, keep our mouths shut, but we can't condemn it. Because if we do, what we are saying is if anybody, if they don't agree with the way I want it done, that wants to restore the Constitution, does something that I don't agree with, I'm going to call them a damn fool, and they don't have anything to do with what I'm doing. If we're not on the same side, if we're allowed to be divided at that point, we will fail. In fact, to the point that I will say it rather bluntly, if the team start doing these things and you have anybody that says they shouldn't be doing that, that's not how we're going to get our country back, disown them or shoot them, one or the other, because they are not on our side. We have to come together somewhere. Are we all going to sit down and vote in a public election? It's time to pick up our rifles and go after the government? We're not going to have Lexington and Concord. So if some people are way ahead of you and ready to take that risk, you owe them every bit of support that you can give them. If you can't, you don't want the Constitution back.
Well, I agree. You know, the shoot them aspect. I don't, you know, I honestly, I believe that when one person begins to start deciding when and when they can, who and whose life they can take and when, and for their own personal reasons, then we come into problems. You know, as has been shown throughout history, I mean, Rockefeller decided that he didn't like unions, so he sent down the State Guard to kill the unions. I mean, physically shoot union members and kill them because he didn't like them because they were bad for his business. That could very easily be turned around as well.
Right,
with,
but, you know, I've explained that,
Washington
and what I've added to the first part of it, which wasn't in there before, you have it, Randy, but I haven't read it, I don't think. But, yes, there has to be care taken in selecting the target that makes it justifiable. But, you know, back then, the targets were justifiable. The people that died as a result of charring and feathering were tax collectors or agents of government. And that's what we're looking at. Now, if we all decide, and Tomahawk, you said something, he acted way too soon. He acted way too soon because the people that had said that we should blow up a government building turned around and accused him of being a government agent after he blew up a government building. If you had been around back then, I was traveling the country, and I heard hundreds of people say, we ought to do something, go blow up a government building, we ought to go to Washington and hang some son of a bitches. All these things were said. Were they shallow expressions of what they wanted? Did they not stand behind their words? When is the point that it is too soon for you? Might not be the same time that it's not too soon for somebody else. And that's what I'm trying to get across. We have to get to a point where we can't turn down those that are willing to do something. Now, Randy, on your point, the person that goes out and commits this act, if he gets the wrong one out of vengeance or something, he's liable to stand trial for his actions at the end of the when we get our government back, because it was murder. It was not an act of restoration of the Constitution. But to do it without breaking the law? Now, think about it. The scenario that I was told earlier tonight effectively caused the death of 80% of the American population. It would be far better to have a few mistakes, and those mistakes be people that work for this government and have been arrogant towards us, have denied, disobeyed their oath to us, they've lied to us, they've cheated from us, they've stolen from us. So if we're going to err and it's one of those, I don't think anybody's going to be tried for murder. If it's a neighbor down the street that never returned a lawnmower, the guy might be tried for murder and end up in prison or hanging by himself at the end of the plan. But you can't. How else would you decide? What are you going to hold an internet tribunal and say these are the people? How can you possibly get more than a small group of people to make that decision? Because once you open that door, they're going to get arrested like the Hutterie militia. So you've made it impossible by your demand for this moral high ground. All we can do is support those that are working in the same direction as us. I can't condemn, Lieutenant's name in My Lai Massacre? I can't condemn him. He was fighting the same war I was. I don't have to support him, but I'm not going to condemn him, because he was over there and told to kill people. He went a little overboard, but I can't condemn him. And the same thing is true now. How can we possibly condemn those that haven't met our moral criteria when there's no forum to determine what that moral criteria could be? Now, if you can conceive a way that we can have internet trials and come up with a list, go right ahead. If you go to the bad guys link, you'll see that I've got a list up there of people. Now, anybody thinks any of those names should come down, that's fine. Give me a good reason, I'll take them down. But what I did is I looked at people that I expected, fully expected, if the Russian government came into this country and asked for people in government or in other organizations to help them take over this country and subdue it, that these people would be what was called collaborators in France, who in many cases were killed at the end of the war. Those that took strong positions were the women that just slept with the Germans, had their hair cut off, and were pushed out naked in the streets sometimes. But how do you judge otherwise without leaving that to the small group that's taking the moral responsibility and the legal responsibility for their actions. I'm waiting for ideas.
Well,
that was a question.
You know, that's the hard part. That's the hard part. The decisions there is how and when. I mean, you know, if we just look at my own political philosophy and my life philosophy, I tend to be very Jeffersonian. I guess I'm more of a libertarian than anything else, even though I don't adhere to a lot of the libertarian ideals, like the, you know, like Rothbard's idea that all government functions can be run by private corporations and they would run much more efficiently and they would obey the people.
And profitably.
But then again, though, how do you replace your police system or your judicial system? And what's to keep these corporations from just all merging and forming into one big, gigantic corporation again? They don't address a lot of this stuff. So a lot of people
have said... That's totalitarian by its very description.
Right. So a lot of people say I'm not a libertarian, but I do not... You know, I will take life. I have no problem taking life if my life is in jeopardy or if somebody else's life is in jeopardy. I have no problem causing physical harm to others if it's in defense of life, liberty, and property. So when we, you know, when you talk about groups going out there and... you know, possibly, in, you know, and engaging in destructive acts, that in its nature is abhorrent to me, yet it's like Joe said, it's the greater of two evils. If you do nothing, people will die. Possibly millions and millions and millions will die. So at what point do you say less will be harmed or injured, less harm or injury will come if I do something than if I do nothing at all? And that's where I am fully agreeing with. You know, Jefferson was much of the same opinion. You know, he abhorred property.
Cause and necessity for taking up arms.
Cause and necessity for taking up arms, you know. So, you know, I have qualms there. You know, I understand human nature and I understand people. And people, when you get a group of people together, mob mentality is quick to rise up. So I think that, you know, it's vital. This plan, like in any community, in any country in the world that's facing tyranny, plans like what you're talking about, a way to restore lawful, benevolent government, couldn't happen unless you have some kind of civil authority overseeing the vast, in fact, overseeing all of it. You really can't. There has to be remain that lawfulness.
Yes, when you get to the security team level, the only way you can possibly do that is to have people in the security team that are too old and feeble like myself to go out on a and they act as the committee of safety. Everything should be done without risking yourself, because remember, the government has informants everywhere, far more than they ever had during the revolution. They have people everywhere trying to find out what's happening. Probably last night, probably all the large militias have been well infiltrated. The only ones that might not be would be the small local militias where everybody's known everybody for a long time. But then if somebody was charged with a crime, he might be an informant at that point, too.
Well, you're very true. Okay. In fact, you know, that essay that you wrote, Informants Amongst Us, and, in fact, you made reference to it in the beginning. You know, how do you trust somebody? Have they ever been arrested? The very fact, I grew up in ghettos, so I used to see people get snatched up off the streets knowing they had drugs and guns on them, and then, you know, a few hours later, they're back on the street.
Back on the streets.
And I know their guns were illegal because I know who they bought them from.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the laws were violated, yet they're back on the street. And like you mentioned before, anybody on probation has to be treated with extreme suspicion as well, because they're still under the control of the man, of the unlawful government.
Unless they come out and say, look, I was charged with the crime, I signed the plea agreement, and I'm under orders to assign to pass on any information to them who can protect me. And at that point, if he's opened up with that, I think that he should be afforded the protection and the inclusion, because he's put his life on the line at that point, and he knows if he steps out of line, he'll be dead. And that's what I pointed out at the end of the article. You know, if we can protect him and bring him back to our side, we should, because that's a tough situation. That friend of mine that had that plea agreement offered to him, man, it was hard. He probably, I don't know, he probably ended up getting his divorce because his wife wanted him to sign the agreement, and he refused to. I know he refused to. It's very hard when you're going to be taken away from, he went to trial, and I don't know what the outcome was. But if he signed the plea agreement, and if they found that he wasn't, didn't satisfy their requirements, and they're the sole determinants of truth, then he goes to prison for whatever period of time was in that agreement. And so he is in a tough situation once he signs it. If you offer him a way out and offer to protect him, you might even be able to use him. You know, there's going to be a raid on, and you can test him too, there's going to be a raid on that truck stop on the west side of town about 12:30 Tuesday night. And then you go down there and see if they show up there and they're responding to him. Then when you want to do a raid, you send them across town. You know, I see an auto accident with 30 cops around it. Every time I see that, now's a good time to rob a bank. Jeez, all the cops are here. You can send their force somewhere else. And that's talked about in Resistance to Tyranny. You know, they talk about intelligence and redirecting the troops to provide, you know, get them on the other side of town. So they got to be an asset to you. Now, he's taking a risk by doing that. But if he's willing to take the risk and you test him and he seems to be supporting it and he doesn't know what your real action is, you can feel comfortable that you can send them to the wrong direction, which is what you want to do. So, but see, somehow, though, there has to be a decision process that allows a group of people who are going to take the risk of their own lives to go out and do something to begin putting the fear of God and the people in the government. How else can it be done? We're going to line up in a line and say, come on, come and get us?
Well, no. Anybody who would do that would be insane. I mean, you know.
So what's the only sane way for us to take the initiative?
Well, like you said.
How can it possibly be done unless you leave it to a small group and everybody agree to back them regardless?
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. You know, for instance, you know, when we look at the Oklahoma City bombings, I cannot speak ill about, you know, what he did, just how he did it. For instance, let's say this was in Cambodia, Laos, the beginning of Nazi Germany, and you know tyranny is coming, you know millions are going to die. Personally, I would have done it in the middle of the night, when there's nobody in there, no children in there, no men in there, no women in there, no we the people that we're supposed to be defending.
Well, wait a minute. The other night when Joe was on, wasn't there discussion about assassinating Hitler?
Yes, there was a discussion about
that. Oh, wait.
That
would not be a building blowing up in the middle of the night. That would be taking a life. What about Goring? Himmler? If they were assassinated, would it have affected the outcome?
I think it would have. If Hitler would have been gotten rid of right away, World War II might not have happened.
So it would have been okay for the Germans to do it in the 30s, but not for us to do it in the 10s?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that massive destruction on that level, where you're taking out a lot of innocent life, during, you know, peak business hours, that is where I draw the line at with, you know, that's where I have disagreements in his actions, but not in his act itself.
Okay, I understand that all of us wear different shoes.
Right. No, that's what I'm saying, you know.
Okay,
so
McVeigh was involved in Iraq. He was killing people. He learned what collateral damage was. He was aware of what happened in Bosnia with the Chinese embassy. But the justification for a bunker in Baghdad was that it supported a government building right next to it. Now, that bunker, and our intelligence should have known this, was for the families of those officials of government. The officials in government were in a bunker under the building, but
yes,
the press applauded the killing of women and children in that bunker with a direct hit by a smart bomb because it was a government facility. In fact, any government facility was a fair game. The United States government said any government building is fair game. Any the trains, the Ford truck plant, the Chinese embassy, the water purification plant, the sewage treatment plant, they're all legitimate military targets. Well, wait a minute. If they can judge them military targets, can't we judge them military targets? Since they're using our authority to make that presumption, back to this assassination, kidnap, and torture? When do we draw the line? Now, McVeigh hit a government building. I wouldn't have done it if it was my job to do it in the middle of the day. I would have done it at night. But it's a government building. Everybody in there had some relationship with government.
True. True.
That's the criteria we use in foreign countries.
This is true.
Right?
We do the same thing in other countries. So, you know, I guess it comes, you know, with me, it comes down to that moralistic value. Like Joe said, though, you know, there comes a point, though, when you have to be willing to cross that line in order to save millions of lives versus worrying about 200 or 300 lives that are you know, opposed to you and helping to support the tyranny that you're under.
Right, and even more importantly, you have the obligation not to condemn those that are ahead of you to pursue that, because, as you admit, you might get to that point sometime. But why should that other guy that's at that point be held back because of you? And if that's the case, how many do we count on to make the decision? Do we want 51%? And if we want 51%, how are we going to tally that 51%? We can't do it.
No.
Therefore, we have to support or keep our mouth shut.
I agree.
Okay. Hope everybody in the chat agrees, too. I mean, that is a very touchy issue. It's one I've given a lot of thought to, believe me, especially after Oklahoma City. I was at Waco. McVeigh was at Waco. I wasn't in Iraq. I was in Vietnam. But I can't condemn McVeigh for what he did. All I can say is I wouldn't have done it that way. That's all I will ever say. I respect McVeigh. I consider him the first patriot of the Second American Revolution. And I hope there are many more that follow him, hopefully not to the gas chamber, though. That's not a gas chamber anymore. A lethal injection chamber. But that's the whole point, is we cannot judge those people on our side. If you have a concern, somebody went after Jane Fonda because he was a Vietnam vet and didn't like what she did back then, that was one that should be tried later on. What is she doing now to support the government? But if it's somebody that has taken an oath to the Constitution, has been elected and is taking our money, or is in an organization that is abusing the Constitution, stealing money from us by grants from the government, like ACORN and SEIU, they're doing all these things.
Well, I agree. I mean,
the
Southern Poverty Law Center, a private foundation, has now been made part of the government. What the hell is this? And anybody who's the Southern Poverty Law Center is now officially part of Department of Homeland Security.
Well, not officially. They're a member of the advisory committee for DHS.
Advisory committee. Who do you think? I mean, you know, foundations are advisory committees to the government. The CFR is just an advisory committee.
Well, look at all the czars, too. They've taken an unconstitutional position that's senior to people that are constitutional in their nature. So all the czars are on the list. And, yes, Southern Poverty Law Center, by what they've done, I would say that they're guilty parties. They're an organization that has done everything they can to undermine our constitutional rights. So, I mean, that's what I would expect the targets to be. I can't see it here and list them. I've listed some, but, you know, that's the judgment that has to be made at the level where the people are willing to take the risk of their own lives to get the job done. And that's where we, the rest of us, cannot damn them for doing what they're doing. And that's, you know, if any, the most important point that we can possibly make in discussing the plan is anybody who discourages the plan does not want return of constitutional government, because I think to the extent that I can, and I'm open to suggestions to make it even even safer if possible, but you can't open up this
well, like you said, you know, when
the determination of guilty parties to the public, it can't be done.
Well, like you said, you know, anytime that tyranny is rising, they're not going to, you know, no dictator has ever been voted out of office. If you can show me one dictator that who has ever been voted out of office, then, you know, I will rethink my opinion on many different things. But no dictator has ever been voted out of office. They've only ever been removed after they've killed millions and millions of their own people by the people. That's it. That's the only way. Sometimes it's been violent. Sometimes it hasn't been. Romania was not a violent revolution, although the government did get violent and killed people during that revolution. The collapse of Russia was not violent, but there was violence being done during that time by the government. So, you know, I'm not opposed to violence whatsoever. I'm not opposed to violence at all. In fact, I uphold my Second Amendment every damn day of my life that I've been able to. You know, I believe in everybody's right to keep and bear arms, because there are those who will take from you what is not theirs to take, including the government.
And those that have, not just the leader, not just the head of state, but those that have participated in that, whether they be in government or not.
Or, you know, even...
actions are demonstrably against the Constitution when they took an oath, if they lied to us, if they violate their oath, they are guilty. The oath should be solemn. It should be as valid as the one that I read that said... if I violate this oath, I am to be considered a traitor.
Well, you know, it goes back, you know, like if we look during Germany or Russia during the rise of the tyranny that was coming there. You know, if you were going to overthrow, if the people were going to rise up to get rid of Stalin, who had just killed 70, 120, 200 million of his own people, the numbers you can't ever seem to get a square number, but we know it was tens of millions at least. That were killed just by starvation in Ukraine. So at what point, I mean, so even the infrastructure like the clerks, the file clerks in these buildings and offices, yes, they support that government. They are part of the problem. They are the reason that government is able to exist. If they refuse to do that job and nobody would do that job, the job could not be done. You know, if police refused to enforce illegal agency regulation on the people and would only enforce the constitutional free, you know, would only secure our freedoms and our liberties, we would have no police brutality. We would not have cops shooting people while they're face down on the ground and handcuffed in San Diego. Or was it Oakland?
No, it happens a lot of places. If you,
that was the most recent one. That was the most recent one. Three or four cops, guy's down handcuffed, guy goes to taser him because he's resisting. How do you resist with four cops on you in handcuffs? But instead of grabbing his taser, he grabs his gun and pumps him in the back and shoots him in the back of the head. You know, if it wasn't for cops like that, this tyranny we have would not exist.
Now, with cops, you've read my article, Popping Cops. Cops are going to be the frontline troops if they come to get our guns. They were in Waco. They were in Phoenix, they were everywhere. The cops are the front line. When the IRS comes, the cops come ahead of them. When the U.S. Marshals come, most often the cops come, the Sheriff's Department or somebody. So cops gets into a very interesting area, and what I pointed out in there, if you've got a cop that constantly violates people's constitutional rights, he should be a target. But be extremely careful, because a lot of cops are going to be on our side when... as the progression of the plan goes. And I think a lot of them will be thankful that it is going back to where it should be. They'll drop the Democrat mentality and realize that us is all of us that believe in the Constitution. There will be some that don't, but you can't prejudge that unless that person, that cop, has acted demonstrably in violation of the Constitution, abusing people, lying to get convictions on the stand, anything that can be proven. But that proof has to be pretty substantial because the Patriot Press is going to have to support the actions of the group. And if they feel they can't support the actions of the group, you still should not condemn the action. You can remain silent on it. But it's going to be up to the public relations people to decide whether they're going to pick up the banner and try and mitigate what has happened. But in no case should we become involved in condemnation of anybody that even remotely has any association with us. The press might try and do it, but we cannot support the press. The government will try and do it, but we cannot support the government.
Well, no, you know, I think part of the whole concept of the Committees of Safety, that part that we're talking about, is to go out there and be that group that gets the public on our side, thus the public support, including law enforcement, including our military, including those politicians who can be made to see the light and the error of their ways and who are willing to change their ways and step down later when the time comes of their own free
right.
will.
Now, if you had looked at the draft that I sent you, I've added another committee. It's the liaison committee, and they'll be the ones primarily responsible for creating this interface with government and corporations, laying the groundwork for, look, the door is open. Whenever you decide to be on the right side, just give us a call. Here's the phone number. In the meantime, we want to keep a good working relationship and communications open with you, and that's going to be the job of a liaison committee, which is expanding as its group, its area of influence expands. So let's see, we've got 9 minutes left. I guess I could read the rest of the resolution.
Well, hang on a second. Before we go into that, we've got about 21 minutes left. I want to open up, if anybody has any questions or would like to call in with their comments, please keep it short, keep it on subject. I don't want to hear about anything else out there, who's doing what, government this and that. We're talking about the plan. So if you'd like to call in and put in your comments, your questions, the phone number is 646-716-4518. If you can also hit me up on Skype, and I can bring you in that way as well. My Skype ID is Randy_Mac. That is free to use. The other one is going to cost you. So if you have free long distance or whatever, great. If you don't mind paying, great. Otherwise, hit me on Skype.
Okay, now I'm going to go through the list of the causes for the dissolution, not independence, but dissolution of government. And I've looked into these, and I'll give you, we have links on them. I don't know if I have the links posted for these yet. The first one, they have created a fourth branch of government that is independent of and not subject to the will of the people. I wrote an article, Who Makes the Laws, about Administrative Agencies Act in 1946, where Congress admitted they were creating a fourth branch of government that is not answerable to the people. They're appointed by the executive branch of government. These are the administrative agencies that write rules that you're bound by, and the Internal Revenue Service happens to be one of them. Their courts refuse to rule upon the constitutionality of matters before them, if at all possible. And I've written an article, Ashwander versus TVA, where the Supreme Court admitted that they will not rule on the constitutionality of a matter before them if they can find any other way to rule, and they list six other ways that they can rule and avoid constitutionality. They have imposed taxes that appropriate fully one-third of the value of one's earnings, and that's a low estimate. I think Randy's well over 40% on what he and I talked about the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would have it as high as 60 or 70 or 80%. They have generated a debt obligation on our posterity, still unborn, into the unforeseeable future. The debt cannot be paid in any conceivable way. Now, the plan does address a way of dealing with that debt, and we'll get into that when we get to that portion of the plan. They have seduced millions of their people into dependence upon that government at the expense of their neighbors. That's called socialism.
Yes, it is.
They have secured for themselves benefit packages approaching those realized by members of royal courts. John Adams had to hire a carriage to get to Washington, D.C. and pay for it out of his own pocket. And now we have people flying three or four people in a big jet at $85,000 an hour.
Michelle Obama went on a little vacation with a lot of her friends, 30 or 40 of them, all at the taxpayers' expense.
$728,000, I think, was the number I saw in that little jaunt.
$728,000 for her to go out and have a weekend with her friends.
Yes, an official duty. So we've allowed the governments just rule themselves. They used to have a limited allocation to their office. Might be $20,000 or $30,000. I remember from my high school days that they got their salary and they got an expense account, and that expense account then covered all the costs associated. It was a fixed fee and covered all the costs associated with their office. Well, Brock would be broke right now as far as his expense account if he had to pay for that trip out of his account. They have allowed the appointment of officials in capacities not recognized by the Constitution, though protected from recourse by the people. That would be the czars. They have established control over state and local governments by funding and obligations associated therewith. And that's where, you know, the strings are created by the federal government to schools, to law enforcement, to almost every branch of government locally. They're bound to the federal government because they receive the funds. They have supported the creation of a standing army amounting to over 1 million officers who have both civil and military authority given them by the government. And that I mentioned before is the article on the library is Are Cops Constitutional? They have expanded the standing army by granting policing powers to many agencies of government who have no need to be armed and authorized to use those arms. Now, this is getting into forestry, fish and game, IRS, tax collection agency. Actually, the FBI, if you think about it, Federal Bureau of Investigation, they're not the Federal Bureau of Assassination. They shouldn't have guns. They have provided undue immunity and impunity to those who have been given such powers. That's Lon Hurushi or cops that don't stand trial that's deemed by the coroner's inquest to be justifiable homicide when they shoot a guy in the back of the head when he's handcuffed lying face down on the ground. That cop, because of publicity, might get punished, but I imagine it won't be very severe. They have enacted laws which have established only two parties from which candidates for federal office may be elected. That denies us freedom of choice. We have the two thirds, the Democratic third and the Republican third. And whichever one we pick, we end up with the third. And the federal government has set up and participated in the exclusion of participation by other parties. If they stood behind their obligation to us as the people, they would require that if there's a debate, that any reasonable candidate should be allowed to participate in the debate. They would not restrict the federal election to only the two parties unless somebody else goes through unnecessary hurdles to get on the ballot. Most states have a winner-take-all provision which would deny any electoral college votes from going to any third-party candidate unless they took the majority of the state. What, Randy?
Oh, you were saying, Randy? You were talking about politicians that aren't part of the Democratic or Republican Party having to jump through impossible hurdles, and I said kind of like in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Well, we are down to
Don DeHaven.
Well, you know, we are down to 90 seconds. Wow, this flew by. Well, listen, everybody, we're down to our last 90 seconds. Do you have anything in closing, Gary?
Come back next week and listen to more and start thinking very seriously about us taking the initiative rather than letting the government decide when they're going to clamp down on us and take everything away. And we will be very anxiously time and probably nearly totally unprepared. A bug-out bag does you no good when you've got cops surrounding your house.
Exactly.
If we take the initiative, the best defense is a good offense. If we take the initiative, we can restore constitutional government with a minimum of bloodshed. And I think a lot of consideration ought to be given to this plan. If you have suggestions to improve it, please send them to Randy, send them to me. This is a work in progress, and these conversations, what Randy says, what you all ask, caused me to think about things, and so we can improve the plan as we go, all of us working together.
I agree. You know, bugging out is a last resort. If we don't have to bug out, why would we? That's a last resort. We should be working to we don't have to bug out. So that's it. Survival Sunday, this Sunday coming up. This coming Monday, we're going to have Georgia Militia on, the oldest lasting militia that we have in this country, supposedly, and possibly the only lawful militia we have in this country. We're going to be finding out about that. So everybody take care, have a great night, and be safe. Bye-bye.
Still there?
Still here, closing down the show. Hang on one second.